Okay, do you want to continue?
Yeah, Eleanor Roosevelt was very much... Have a cookie, Gabby.
Okay, while I'll have I'm, a cookie while I'm talking. Done. So.
Mary, have a couple cookies. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't eat them, I will, and I'll get fat.
Now then you'll have a mouthful.
Eleanor Roosevelt, do you know there's a town named after her?
Oh, really? Where?
Norvelt. It's down in Westmoreland County, I believe.
Norvelt. Eleanor.
Yeah, it's in Westmoreland County, I believe. It's down in the Mon Valley. She was, it seemed that she spent half her time in West Virginia. She was so sweet, so kind, and... you know, you could meet those people one-on-one in those days. Somehow there were fewer problems with security, and to interview a president, it became increasingly difficult over the years. And I don't know how many times I had to get security clearance from the Defense Department or from the Secret Service or from some agency. I had an interesting afternoon with Dwight Eisenhower and his wife. I loved Mamie because she looked a lot like my mother. She and my mother were lookalikes, and he was a pretty good guy, considering the fact that his accomplishments in office were all not that very great. I campaigned through West Virginia and Pennsylvania with John F. Kennedy. On the campaign trail with him. We rode in a bus together. There were no Secret Service people on it. When I think back on it, it's kind of incredible that they were that available. Access to them was that unrestricted that I remember drinking out of the same bottle with John F. Kennedy.
What?
Milk.
Okay.
I was hoping you would ask me. But I did interview him once in his underwear. In one of those Fleet Trap hotels that we stayed in on the West Virginia tour. When he got word that he had won the West Virginia primary, I was in a basement office in one of the hotels in Wheeling, I think it was. Or was it Charleston? And I was with him when he got the word that he had won. And that was the big hurdle that got him the nomination and the election and blah, 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 you know. But that was the key point. He had to have that that delegation going into the convention in order to get the nomination. It was his strategy, his father's strategy, I later learned. But I was with him when he and his knockout dynamite wife got word, Jacqueline Bouvier, got word that he had won the West Virginia primary. What can I tell you about presidents I've known? Lyndon Johnson was...
How about Nixon? Well, first, tell us about Johnson.
Johnson was a largely uncouth and really... A friend of mine, Sid Davis, who was a bureau chief in our Washington bureau, was very partial to Lyndon Johnson because Johnson gave him little scoops every once in a while. And I thought that Sid liked Johnson a lot. And I could never understand why, because Johnson was a jerk. He was just a lowbrow. And I didn't think he was very presidential. Richard Nixon, I didn't meet Nixon one-on-one, and subsequent to his, I was no longer newsman, subsequent to his term, and all the Republicans that have come along since then, but as a talk show host, I scrutinized their career, their activities, and I kind of feel that I didn't really miss a whole hell of a lot.
You talk about West Virginia. Were you involved at all with the Oblonsky murder?
Oh, yeah.
You talk anything about?
Yeah, I have. I'm glad you asked me about it. Jacques Oblonsky declared his intention to run for the presidency on my talk show. I had met Oblonsky a few times at mine disasters. He was a dissident officer in the coal miners union, United Mine Workers. And he always had his own little team of followers, but he was always out of favor. It was as though there were two teams of principals coming from the mine workers' union at these mine disasters, and I got to be acquainted with Jock Yablonsky, and I kind of liked him because he was available, and he seemed to me kind of a diamond in the rough. I liked him a lot. I was impressed a lot with him. At the same time, I thought the president of the union was a jerk of the first order. And one night, Yablonsky did the talk show by telephone from Washington. Instead of he was supposed to come into town that weekend, and he was unable to keep the appointment, and because he had something doing, what he was doing was declaring for the president, and I kind of got the first announcement of that on the talk show by telephone. And I remember that it surprised me that he was going up against an entrenched leadership.
What was the name of the president?
Can't tell. While I'm talking about him, I can't think of it. I can Sorry. Visualize him in my mind's eye. He's he died in jail, didn't he? Or he's dying in jail, or one or the other. But he got a long sentence for the murder of Jock Yablonsky. But in any event, Jock declared his candidacy, and he did something that impressed me a whole lot. Voluntarily, he said that one of the issues that he was going to make a campaign issue was safety in the coal mines. He believed, as I did, that the mine workers union had not done enough to improve the working conditions. They focused on above ground working conditions. They focused on wages and hours more than anything else, and the conditions in the coal mines were and I steadfastly believe they are just as primitive and unsafe today as they were when the first coal mine was dug 200 years ago. But he said that safety was going to be his campaign, and he was going to run against, what's his name? And he did real well. But as a matter of fact, he was destined to become a new leader, and it would have been a new era, a new day for coal miners in America had he lived. And then along came the murder, the triple murder of Yablonsky, his wife, and their daughter. And I was horrified. I was really deeply disturbed by that. Becoming a talk show host has enabled me to become more affectionately, more emotionally involved with the people that I met than I was as a newsman. And I liked Yablonsky. A talk show host can like or dislike people. A newsman can't afford to take an emotional attitude one way or the other, but I liked Yablonsky, and I remember his voice. And I was horrified. And I remember the eventual arrests and the prosecution, the kind of a domino effect. The prosecutor, what the hell was his name? I'm terrible on names, just terrible. It's the shame of my, embarrassment of my life. The guy from Philadelphia who prosecuted them, but he worked his way up the ladder by getting one of the conspirators to snitch on the others, and eventually the list of suspects widened, and eventually it got to be the officers and the president of the union, and he gained convictions and swung deals along the line, and eventually got the whole rat's pack of them in prison. And it was a marvelous piece of jurisprudence, prosecution. How did you happen to ask me about if I knew Jock Yablonsky?
Because you were talking about West Virginia.
Well, I did a lot of news in West Virginia. I won a national award for covering a flood in West Virginia.
Want to talk about that? No, I don't think so. Let's talk in relation to unions, since Pittsburgh is the headquarters for unions. Do you have any other incidents to relate to it?
I became acquainted here, of all places, with the guy who served several years as president of the Teamsters. What was his name?
Coffa.
Jimmy?
Yeah. Tell us what really happened.
You really want to know what happened? My lips are sealed. I can't tell you. But I met Jimmy Hoffa here, and at his invitation, went down to Washington and interviewed him. He was a straight shooter with me. He was, I can only judge people the way they treated me, and he treated me with courtesy, respect, and was available for interview when I wanted him. He was a pretty straight guy. He was, of course, a criminal, a crook, a murderer, and all of those things, but he treated me well. How many presidents of the Steelworkers Union, Dave McDonald, and I were well acquainted? Who else? I met them all. You can't be a reporter in Pittsburgh without getting involved in strikes and negotiations, and God, I wish I had a nickel for every story that I covered.
Okay. Other people you mentioned... Governor Rockefeller, you last
Nelson
week
Rockefeller.
Alluded to him a little. You said how much
a sad thing popped into my mind. I worked at the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph with a guy named Eddie Romano. Eddie Romano was a photographer. And I was working at KDKA in the newspaper field, and I was able to help get him a job as a motion picture photographer for KDKA-TV when the Sun-Telegraph went down by the Stern. Eddie Romano... was killed. I was in Florida at the time that it happened. He was on a labor disturbance. There was a Teamster strike at one of the oil refinery locations in the Lawrenceville section of Pittsburgh. Eddie was shooting pictures at the scene when a scab driving a truck out of the plant gate ran over him and killed him. And that upset me so badly that I lost a good friend. But Eddie and I worked together for years and years. First in newspaper work and later in covering news for radio and TV. But it was a labor dispute that caused his death. He was blindsided. He never saw what hit him, but it literally one of those big double-wheeled things rolled over him and crushed him to death. Labor disturbances of covered strikes, bad strikes, violent strikes. I've seen... violence on the picket line. I've seen bombings. I have seen paint bombings. I've seen shootings that have occurred in labor disturbances. And I've always gotten along good with the workmen, with the strikers, with the leadership of the unions, and with management too. I like to think that I did a pretty fair job. But working in Pittsburgh, labor was a big part of the news scene here. Who are you asking me about?
Next, I was going to ask you about Rockefeller.
Nelson Rockefeller. I met him first at the governor's conference in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Don't ask me what year that was. He was a freshman governor, and he was considered something of a bumpkin. Politically, he was unsophisticated, and he was not given a whole lot of prestige, not much respect. Governors of states are invariably political veterans. Governors have very wonderful jobs. They're very exalted on the gubernatorial scale. When you're a governor, you have a mansion, you have a staff of servants, you have chauffeurs, you have stooges and flunkies and sycophants circling you. And Nelson, among the family of governors at the governor's conference, wasn't given a whole lot of respect. Of course, I can't, as a reporter, I couldn't... say that, but I met him first there. He was nice to me. He seemed like a very nice guy. But when he made a couple of speeches to the assembled body, that was a pretty huge round table of political veterans. They talked about some national issues that affected their states. Nelson Rockefeller was not really, he didn't have a whole lot of friends. I saw him mature politically. And when I went to New York City to work as a newsman for WINS, I met him on several occasions, interviewed him, and became acquainted with him. As a newsman for WINS, there were three of us, and we were rather prominent in the community, but the politicians loved us because the radio station and all news operation had a tremendous audience. And I think for that reason, Nelson Rockefeller always went out of his way to be nice to me. But I liked him, and I thought that he became a very good governor. And when there was a riot at Attica, and the hostage-holding inmates demanded that he come there to the scene, and he refused, I was totally incredulous. I could not believe that he wouldn't go there to the scene, and I think that things might have been different, might have been a lot different if he had taken, if he had just been a little bit more kind and a little bit more tolerant and hadn't been so goddamn noble and stubborn in refusing to go there. As you know, the riot, the hostage situation went on for days and days, and it ended with an army of state troopers going into the prison. And a lot of people died there that were killed by the guns of the troopers that went in. And I think it could have been prevented by Nelson Rockefeller if he had handled things differently. And I was very, very disappointed in that because I liked him a lot. And I thought that he was a pretty good governor at the time that I was a newsman in New York City. Subsequently, one of the other news reporters on the street, wife died. Tragic death of heart attack. And in the final hours of her life, when she was struggling to stay alive, Nelson Rockefeller kept him company in the emergency room at University Presbyterian Hospital in New York City, I think it was. But I was back here in Pittsburgh at that time. And I remember him. He took a day and a half and just kept Doug company at the hospital, which is, if he could do something like that, he could have gone to Attica. A little compassion, but I think it was probably somebody advising him that it might look as though he was bending. He was bending to the situation in Attica. The prisoners were all street smart hoodlums from New York City, and the guard staffs and all the hostages were people from the village outside the prison. And there was I guess the governor didn't go there because it would have looked as though he was being condescending or dancing to the tune as dictated by the strikers, or the rioters, the prisoners. What other famous people did I meet? Some of the most marvelous people I ever met were the seven Mercury astronauts, the first team of American astronauts. I went down to, at one time, the American space program was headquartered at Langley Field, Virginia. They had a couple of buildings that were outside a research facility there. And I remember when I interviewed the first astronauts, we would have to stop every once in a while because the wind tunnel, they did a lot of testing of aeronautical things and huge wind tunnels. But the big wind tunnel outside the building would crank up and fire up, and you couldn't hear yourself think, so I'd have to stop the interview, sometimes for half an hour, and we'd just sit there and shout at each other until the wind tunnels shut down. But I got to know them, and there was a very small crew of newsmen in the early days of the space program, so we lived together when we went down to Florida. The whole team of news people, astronauts, the astronauts' families, and the top leaders in the NASA program all stayed together in one motel for the first couple of space shots. My favorite astronaut was Wally Schirra. Wally had a little boy. I used to play with his little kid. Strange reason to love an astronaut, but his son was 7 years old, and when we weren't working, we used to go to the pool. It was hot as blazes there. I hate Florida because of that, but I used to play with his son in the swimming pool. Wally Schirra was additionally a very good-looking guy. He eventually became, after he left the space program, he became the spokesman for the American railroad industry. But he was a good interview. I loved John, what's his name, John Glenn. He was too good to be true. Mr. Goody Two-Shoes, the Eagle Scout. And I knew that I was not surprised when he became a United States Senator from Ohio. But he was a good interview, and he was a really nice guy, very knowledgeable. They were all very personable, and in the early days of the space program, it was very, very exciting. Very, very exciting. And I loved doing the job, but it required a tremendous amount of study, a lot of work, and I had to do a lot of homework to know about the rockets and the boosters and the spacecraft. But I met them all, and we were fairly close together, living there together in a motel. My wife suggested I tell you about Ham. I had trouble getting into the space program as an accredited member of the news pool. And later, after the first couple of trips to Langley Field, and then down to Florida to Cape Canaveral, I had trouble becoming a pool reporter because the public relations man for the space program, a guy named John Powers, Shorty Powers, at a long all-night session, demanded to know from me why I wanted to be in the pool. There was a small pool of reporters, a magazine photographer, a newspaper reporter, a newspaper photographer, and a motion picture photographer for TV, and I wanted in as a radio reporter, and he demanded whether I could do a credible job of journalism. It was insulting as hell, and subsequently we became very good friends. Shorty Powers became an alcoholic and a sales representative for an encyclopedia company, and has drifted off into obscurity. God knows where he is now, but in the middle of the night, we had one hell of a fight because he really questioned whether, as a radio reporter, I could do a credible job of reporting, and I had to make all kind of promises that I would share the tape, share my experiences, and as a matter of fact, it was my observations as a pool reporter in the first space shot that carried a chimpanzee.
That was him.
The monkey, the chimpanzees, they told me you mustn't call them monkeys because they weren't. The monkey was strapped into his little cutesy space suit and put inside a space pod where he had little handles to, he had little chores to do in flight. And they put him in the space capsule, and I held my tape recorder microphone up, and he chattered and making the monkey sounds the way he does, and he bared his teeth in what I thought was a grin, and I said he was behaving like a ham. And the space people, the space program people, had been trying desperately not to give the chimpanzee a name. They didn't want to personalize him because they confided that there was a good possibility that he would be blown to smithereens on blast off, or he might not come back to Earth intact, but they were sending him up, and they were testing the hardware at the same time they were trying to find out if a human body could perform under the conditions of weightlessness and extra G's during blast off and landing. But I said he behaved like a ham, and that gave the chimpanzee his name because the other newsmen immediately referred to him as Ham. That's my contribution to the American Space Program.
Oh, that's wonderful. When you mentioned Ham, a thought came to me. Did you find any anti-Semitism in the news business?
You know, it doesn't pop into my head that I did.
People often
ask me when I worked for the Sun Telegraph.
Yeah.
They occasionally people would ask me, "That's the anti-Semitic newspaper, isn't it?" And of course it wasn't. And a lot of the Hearst executives were Jewish, and some of the staff people on the Hearst newspaper. There was a sports editor who preceded me at the Sun Telegraph who was Jewish. It was Julius Levine. And I've always thought that there was a notable lack of Jewish journalists on the staff of the Pittsburgh Press at the time that people were referring to the Sun Telegraph as anti-Semitic. I subsequently learned that Isidore what was his name, Schransky, got a job on the city staff of the Pittsburgh Press, the competition newspaper, and broke the Jewish barrier for them. But there was no problem about being Jewish in the broadcast industry, radio or TV. And I always felt rather comfortable. The Westinghouse Broadcasting Company has always had a lot of Jewish, KDKA has always had Jewish employees, and it never did occur to me that there was anti-Semitism that had to be overcome.
Locally, we talked, no, I think you mentioned, but we didn't talk about Bill Burns. Anything tell us about Bill Burns?
Well, Bill's in Florida now. He broke his hip recently when he fell and had a long, painful recuperation. But Bill and I go way back together. He used to be a reporter for KQV, a news reporter. So, and he was not like a lot of other Ken and Barbie doll anchor people. He covered news. He did a lot of news out on the street. I have pictures of Bill and I doing news stories together at the time that he was an anchor man. He was also a working journalist. He knew the difference between a good story and a bad one. He knew he had a good nose for news. And I've known and respected Bill for a long time.
Locally, you mentioned Bill Green's nightclub. Can you elucidate?
Bill Green's nightclub.
Yeah.
I used to live not far from where it was.
Yeah.
Bernice and I had rented an apartment there, but I was a lifeguard 1,000 years ago at South Park Swimming Pool, and one of the other lifeguards was a guy who was at that time a law student and used to attend classes in the summertime, and he was a law student in the morning, lifeguards in the afternoon, and at night he used to be the maitre d' at Bill Green's nightclub. And he was studying law while he was supposed to be a lifeguard. And I'm trying to remember his name, John. He's a judge now. See, and I've come up against that problem about remembering names. He's a member of Common Pleas Court now, and one of the respected jurists, but he was a host at Bill Green's nightclub. Did you go to Bill Green's nightclub?
No, I'm not a Pittsburgher.
Oh.
I'm married to it.
Married
to it. But tell us about what makes Bill Green's nightclub special.
Bill Green had big bands there, and I guess it was never very expensive, but you could go there for a price of a couple drinks. You could dance to the music of. It was the place to go when you had a very heavy date.
Where was
and
it?
It was in Pleasant Hills. It was way out Route 51. Oh, it was out on the edge of the city at that time. Beyond there, the world was flat. Beyond there, that was the outer limits of Pittsburgh. But it was a huge nightclub, and he got all the big entertainers, performers, singers, and the big bands. And to go there on a date was that was real heavy duty stuff. That was wonderful.
Also mentioned the Casino Burlesque Theater.
Yeah, that was down on what was then called Diamond Street. It was not; it's now Forbes Avenue. And it was a burlesque theater, and had coochie dancers and strip teasers and burlesque comedians. It was on what they called the wheel. There were burlesque theaters in most major American cities, and the performers used to do the circuit. And literally, they would go around in a circular pattern as they traveled around the country, and they called it the wheel. I think there's a saloon, a restaurant in downtown Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. called the wheel, and that's how it got its name, I believe. But they had all the name Sally Rand and who were some of the
Gypsy Rose Lee
was there. But my friend Frank Schenkel was the publicity man for the, he would arrange interviews and do publicity for the performers. And it wasn't, while it was pretty racy for its time, it was not filthy and disgusting the way some of the erotic hot erotic action is today. It was bump and grind stuff and dirty jokes. It was always, always a comedian or two on every show. And Frank would do publicity about some of the comedians went on to become stage performers, and one of them, Red Fox, just died recently. He's an old burlesque performer, I believe. Unless I'm mistaken, Milton Berle did burlesque, but that was a fixture in downtown Pittsburgh. When I was a kid, I was an usher in another fixture in downtown Pittsburgh. The Nixon Theater was located where the Alcoa building is now. And I used to be an usher on opening night. Monday was not the dead night in Pittsburgh that it is today. Monday night was opening night for a lot of live performances. And I went when I was in high school and college. I went with my cousin, Kenny Sivitz, down to the stage door, and we were ushers. We would show people to their seats. And then the payment for being an usher was you got to see the performance. And you had to go in and out of the stage door. That was always pretty glamorous stuff, because we got to